A significant number of colleges are basing their admissions on a student's grades rather than test scores.
We don't find that test scores are all that predictive of how students do in college.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about a new set of answers to the GPA versus test scores question. We'll also meet someone who went from art school to the Beatles, Scooby-Doo too. And we'll spend an academic minute writing an autobiography. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A student's high school grade point average is 5 times stronger than their ACT scores at predicting college graduation. That's according to a new study published in Educational Researcher, a peer-reviewed journal of the American Educational Research Association. The study examined 55,084 students who graduated from the Chicago Public School District between 2006 and 2009 and immediately enrolled in a 4-year college. Here to talk about the study is Elaine Allensworth, director of the University of Chicago Consortium on School Research. I asked her why they took on this study.
Well, we've been doing research to try to support improvements in college outcomes for students in Chicago and across the country for a long time. And our research just constantly shows us that high school GPAs are an incredibly strong predictor of how students do in college, and that really students need to be earning A's and B's in high school if they are going to have a good chance of success when they get to college. But every time we present this research, people say, but aren't grades subjective? You know, doesn't it depend on where you go to school? People dismiss grades as important signals about how students are prepared for college because they think they don't mean the same thing from one high school to another. And then they'll almost immediately follow up with, well, really test scores are a more reliable source of information, you know, and that test scores have the same meaning across high schools. But, you know, in our research, we, first of all, don't find that test scores are all that predictive of how students do in college, especially once you compare students with similar GPAs. And on top of that, no one has actually tested that. You know, there's this idea that because everyone takes the same tests under the same conditions, that they have the same meaning. But the fact is you can prepare for those tests in very different ways that have different implications for how you do in college. You know, they really measure only a small subset of the skills students are going to need when they get to college, and they do it in a very specific way. And when you get to college, you're not just going to be taking timed multiple choice tests. You might be doing some of that, but you're also going to be writing papers and doing presentations and group projects, and you're going to have to show effort over a long period of time, not just concerted effort at one point in time. You're going to have to know a broad array of things. You know, standardized tests tend to focus on math and English language arts skills, and when you get to college, you need to know a lot more about the world and have different ways of processing information and have strong study skills and all these other kinds of skills and knowledge that you're going to need that standardized tests don't capture. So anyway, so we thought, well, let's look, you know, everyone says, well, test scores can provide this neutral indicator. So let's look to see if they really are. Do they provide the same meaning depending on which high school you go to? And we found that they don't.
Did you compare this among both of the big tests, the SAT and the ACT?
No, we just looked at the ACT because all students in Illinois at the time, the students that we studied went to high school, they all took the ACT. So that way we could, you know, look at all of the students with the same tests. Now students in Illinois take the SAT, but they haven't had enough time at this point to have college outcomes for us to be able to study them.
Were any findings of the survey surprising to you?
I would say, yeah. I mean, the fact that many high schools' ACT scores have almost no relationship with college graduation was surprising. And at the high scores, many high schools' higher scores actually were associated with lower college outcomes. That was very surprising. I think that's likely because people are using ACT scores as a signal that students are ready for very rigorous programs when they're probably not as good of a signal as something like GPAs. And so students, you know, think they're ready for programs that maybe they're not ready for.
Did you look into anything besides those scores? Did you look into like economic factors?
First of all, we compared students with similar economic backgrounds, race, ethnicity, and gender. And then we looked at school SES, so the average economic background of students at a school, as well as the average test score of students at a school. And we do see there are relationships so that students from more affluent schools, schools with higher average test scores, are more likely to succeed than students with the same high school GPAs and individual ACT scores at other schools. And so that says to us, okay, maybe it's something about the rigor of the program at school with more, you know, economic resources and higher achieving students. It could also be that families with more resources tend to send their students to particular schools, and then they continue to offer resources to those students when they get to college. We need to do more research to disentangle that.
Do you think that colleges and universities may have suspected this all along, as many schools are going test-free?
Oh, yes. I'm sure that most colleges are doing their own institutional research and recognize that the high school GPAs are more predictive than test scores. You know, there is pressure because there's so, you know, colleges are judged by the test scores of their incoming students, the incoming ACT and SAT scores. And so there is pressure on colleges to accept students with high test scores so that they look good on those ratings. But I do think many colleges have recognized that GPAs are a better indicator of how students will do, which is one reason that they're going test optional in higher numbers.
And a lot of schools, colleges, universities get a lot of their funding if they continue to graduate students at a proper pace.
Mm-hmm. Increasingly, that's so. I think people are starting to pay more and more attention to the institutional graduation rates. And if, you know, the more that colleges care about how well students are graduating, the more they are likely to be looking at students' incoming high school GPAs.
Has there been any response from the testing companies on this?
Not yet.
Okay.
I imagine that they are somewhat aware of the research. You know, maybe, maybe not. They do a lot of, you know, both the College Board that puts out the SAT and ACT, they do a lot of their own research, but they tend to do research that uses students' self-reported GPAs. So when you take the ACT or the SAT, you know, there's some preliminary questions, and they ask you to fill in what your GPA is, and they use that for a lot of their research to look at the validity of the test, the SAT or ACT. But the problem with the self-reported GPAs is that they are not as accurate as students' actual GPAs. And so a lot of times they'll conduct these validity studies that say, oh, you know, the SAT or the ACT predicts college outcomes beyond just students' high school GPA. So they'll say control, you know, looking at students with the same GPA, you know, the test further predicts how they'll do in college. But when studies use students' actual GPAs, then those relationships tend to disappear.
Looking ahead, do you see surveys like yours, and I'm sure there are others that will show similar findings, do you think it'll make colleges and universities adjust either more towards test-free, or might even, you know, make the testing companies adjust their way of doing business?
Yeah, I think we need to have some serious conversations about how we're using tests in this country. There's so much reliance right now on the standardized tests, and I think that's because, one, people believe that they're highly predictive of how students are going to do, and then, two, people believe that they're neutral, that they provide some kind of neutral assessment of how prepared students are across different curricula, different high schools. But the fact is, first of all, they are not strongly predictive, especially at the individual student level. or at least not nearly as predictive as people think they are. And a lot of that signal, a lot of the relationship that exists between test scores and college outcomes comes from the fact that colleges select students based on their test scores, right? So for a student with higher test scores, it's easier to get into a college with more resources if you have a stronger test score. And then you're also eligible for scholarships and things like that. So, you know, one is, you know, if they're not all that predictive, you know, how strongly should we be relying on them as a signal of whether students will do well in different kinds of programs? And I think we need to do, you know, to really think about that and really look at how strongly they predict how students do in different programs. And then the second is this idea that they somehow adjust for differences across schools in terms of what the GPA means. I mean, yes, GPAs are not necessarily equivalent from one high school to another, but individuals' own ACT or SAT score doesn't do a good job of providing a balance. It's really looking at the overall, you know, achievement of students at a particular high school that gives you more information.
Well, after this, is there any further research that can be done on this topic?
There's so much research that needs to be done. One thing, you know, we found is that there are these substantial high school effects, so that where a student goes to high school makes a difference for whether they graduate from college. And that's comparing students with the same GPA, the same ACT score, right? So there are these high school effects. Now, that may come from differences in curriculum, perhaps, but, you know, I also know that weighted GPAs are less predictive than unweighted GPAs, so, you know, curriculum doesn't seem to be the whole answer. It could be that there are different resources, supports. You know, some high schools will try to prepare students for college by focusing on college knowledge, the things that you need to know to get through college. There's financial supports that some high schools are putting in place to make sure students can make that transition to college, and or microloans. We know there are relationships between the diversity of students' experiences in high school and then how they do in college. There are all these questions about what it is that high schools are doing. I do worry, you know, we see that part of those high school effects can be explained by the average achievement level of students at the school or the average economic circumstances at the school. I wouldn't want people to rely on those to say, well, how well is the school preparing students, right? Because then we'll always say, oh, the school serving more affluent students are doing a better job, when that actually might not be the case. There might be some schools that are serving mostly low-income students that are doing a great job. And so really understanding what it is that high schools are doing that makes a difference, I think, is really important.
Elaine Allensworth is the director of the University of Chicago Consortium on School Research. You can see the full study in the Journal of the American Educational Research Association. Still to come, we'll talk to a student who went from art school to the Beatles, and he can't play a note. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. If you've ever seen a cartoon on TV in your life, you've probably seen the work of Ron Campbell. Beginning in the late 1950s, in his native Australia, Campbell had a 50-year career as an animator and director of some of the most iconic TV shows that ever graced a Saturday morning, from Popeye and Crazy Cat to DuckTales and Rugrats. In the 1960s, he became involved with the wildly popular animated show starring the Beatles, and that led him to working on the movie Yellow Submarine. Ron Campbell is retired now and takes his artwork from those days to various art galleries around the world. I spoke to him recently and asked how he got a start in this business.
I got into the business, actually, as a seven-year-old, you know, that began a lifetime of grim determination in a country where there was no industry, no animation industry at all. But fortunately, when I came out of art school, television had just arrived in Australia, and for the first time, there was a demand for animation to make television commercials. So I was able to walk around the streets of Sydney pretending I knew how to make animated television commercials. And by doing, I learned.
And how did you get further into the business? Doing the commercials, I imagine you must have been good at it.
Well, I was apparently able to do it to the satisfaction of the advertising agencies. And then an American company came snooping around in Australia looking for production help. That company was King Features of New York. And they brought with them the possibility of contracts to make Popeye cartoons, other cartoons like Crazy Cat and Beetle Bailey. And I found myself doing that for King Features, and that worked out okay. I was able to deliver on budget and on time. Then I got a telephone call in the middle of the night. I was in Sydney, and I was getting the call from New York, Al Brodax of King Features. And he said, "Ron, we've just sold a show for next season. We'd like you to direct all the episodes we plan to produce in Australia. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Oh, absolutely, Al. What's the show?" And he said, "It's the Beatles." And I stopped and, "Beatles? Al," I said, "insects make terrible characters for children's television." He said, no, it's the Beatles, the rock and roll group sweeping the nation, you know. And I'd only barely heard of them, I'm afraid. But I quickly learned who the Beatles were.
Well, you'd already done Beetle Bailey, so you had half of it.
Yes, right. That's true.
So how involved were the Beatles involved at all in this?
Well, they were involved in a very, very significant way and also utterly uninvolved. The significant way, of course, was that they gave us the right to use their music, which was everything. And then they went away and did their music thing, and we went away and did our cartoon thing. And so we had an enormously successful television show, thanks to their music. And it was a fun show, and children all over America loved the show. And now that I'm doing art shows, I'm meeting that audience in person, and I am amazed at how many millions of people, millions of Americans, still think back to that happy time when they were watching the Beatles cartoon television show. It had like, sometimes it had like a 67 share. That meant every 100 TV sets that were turned on during that time period, 67 of them were watching the Beatles, our Beatles TV cartoon show. An amazing thing that could never happen today.
I will confess right now that one of those TVs was in my living room. I watched it every week. Yep.
See, wherever I go, I meet people who were little children at that time watching that show. It's amazing.
I'm interested in learning. You said you were directing the show. How does one direct a cartoon?
Well, in those days, it meant a lot more than it does now, actually. In those days, it meant I decided how many people were to be employed, who was to be employed, how did the workflow go. I did the storyboards. New York sent me a voice track and a script, and I delivered to them a finished film. And I was responsible for everything. That's how you directed a show then. And I was 24 years old. How did I have the knowledge to do that? I don't know. I look back, somehow I did, you know, and I think it was because I taught myself, you know.
From that, how did you go from that to getting involved in their movie?
Oh, the movie was different. After the success of The Beatles, I did another TV show called Cool McCool for King Features. And then I started getting a lot of job offers from the United States. So I packed my beautiful wife up and my lovely little three-year-old daughter, and we flew across the Pacific and we joined the American animation industry. I worked for a year for Hanna-Barbera, and then I started my own company. And while helping out on the first season of Scooby-Doo, doing storyboards and animating a show you might have heard of called George of the Jungle and Tom Slick and Super Chicken.
These are amazing shows you're bringing up right now. These are great.
Yeah, I get another telephone call from New York. Not New York. Al was in London when he called me. And he told me that there was a lot of problems in the production of the film they were making called The Yellow Submarine, and that they needed character animation between the songs, and they needed a lot of help. Could I help out? And I was working with a very good animator at that time, and a very close personal friend of mine. His name was Dwayne Crowther. I agreed, and Dwayne agreed to help out with this. And so we took on the task of doing about 12 minutes of the animation of The Yellow Submarine, just the animation. They sent the scenes to us in Hollywood, and Dwayne and I animated the scenes with a few assistant animators helping us. And we sent all the pencil drawings back to London, where they inked and painted them and painted the backgrounds, filmed them, and slipped the scenes into the movie where they belonged. We did about 12 minutes, just 12 minutes of the film. We're not responsible for the magnificent design and everything that's really good in the film, except we did provide them with some great character animation on the Blue Meanies and Max the Assistant and the Nowhere Man. We did about 12 minutes, as I say, and it took us 8 months to do.
Wow.
So, you know, all of the magnificent stuff on The Yellow Submarine was really done in London by TVC, by Heinz Edelman and all the directors in London. They did a marvelous job on the film, and the film has stood the test of time. It was released just a couple of years ago to enormous success again. Nobody has ever watched that film without being influenced by it in some way.
I want to go back to a show that might have been one of the first things you worked on. I'm not sure. I remember it as a kid. Is Winky Dink and You? It says you worked on that.
Are you going to mention? Winky Dink? Oh my goodness!
Not many people will go from the Beatles to Winky Dink. I'll tell you.
I have to tell you, of all of the shows that I've worked on, and I've given 10 years of my life to the Smurfs and 10 years of my life to Rugrats. And you mentioned Winky Dink.
Well, that's because I was part animator in that show, too. The kids had to draw on the screen.
Yeah, you did. Yes, it was a real strange thing, which was kind of strangely popular with small children. And sometimes it got the children into trouble with their parents because they didn't get the screen. They actually drew directly onto the TV set.
I can confirm.
So, you know, what can I say about Winky Dink? It was just a little sideways thing that I forgot all about until the computer comes along and tells everybody what you did, even things that you forgot you even did, you know?
Well, it sounds like you also were very involved in the creation of Scooby-Doo, and I can't think of many cartoon characters more popular than that in the U.S.
Well, I was just involved really in the opening scene of it, and there was some preamble stuff the year before, doing storyboards on the very first season, and then later on in the 70s, I subcontracted a few episodes for Hanna-Barbera, where my studio was across the road from Hanna-Barbera, and Bill Hanna used to send subcontract stuff to Overflow Production to my studio.
Does the job that you started doing even exist anymore? Hand animation, I'm talking about.
Oh, I see, yes. Virtually no, it doesn't exist anymore. Right now, if you look at feature films that are generated by computers, they're just technically so far advanced from anything that can be done by hand. On the other hand, I'm not sure that the computers have been helpful for television entertainment for children, but there is a charm that hand-drawn animation brings to the imagery that computers cannot compete with, but there are many things the computer can do that no hand-drawn animation could even remotely come near. So it's like a different medium altogether. And right now, hand-drawn animation is not that popular. It will come back, I know, because it does have a charm that no computer can touch.
Ron Campbell spent 50 years as an artist, animator, and director. You can see Ron's artwork and find his schedule of exhibitions at BeatlesCartoonArtShow.com. If you're thinking about writing an autobiography, you might want to think again. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is your story fit for an autobiography? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Kenneth Romer, distinguished teaching professor at the University of Texas Arlington, looks into this question.
In creative writing programs, students flock to autobiographical courses. Trouble is, most of their and our lives are made up of mundane happenings that don't invite profound self-creations. Beginning around 1980, I addressed this problem by using The Way to Rainy Mountain by Pulitzer Prize-winning Kiowa author N. Scott Momaday. Since then, students at my university and many others, and even in prison classrooms, have used variations of Momaday's method to create intriguing autobiographies. They place their life events in two types of contexts: family, community, or cultural stories, and local or regional histories. For example, in one of Momaday's childhood experiences, he watches water spiders skitter across a slow-moving creek surface and sees his image in the water. A frog leaps into the creek and breaks the image. In the storytelling voice, the son's child ignores grandmother spider's warning not to throw a ring in the air. The ring falls and splits him into two boys who eventually become the Kiowa hero twins. The historical voice captures Momaday's aging grandfather as he gets down from a horse for the last time. By association, Momaday's mundane experience is now part of a hero tale and a life-changing event. Students use this multi-voice method to create engaging life narratives that take on lives beyond the classroom, in publications, or more intimately as they show their work to family and friends. They not only create, they also share and expand their identities in ways they might never have imagined.
That was Kenneth Romer of the University of Texas Arlington. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. Thank you.